8 years ago, I walked into the studio to do this show not knowing whether it was true or not that along with the jets involved in the terrorist attack on the Pentagon and World Trade Center towers, a Korean Airlines cargo plane had been hijacked and was aimed at downtown Anchorage. Of course, that didn't happen. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. It's time for a security update on National Preparedness Month. Do you feel safer than you did on that day? Our number 1-800-478-8255, toll free. In Anchorage, a local call 550-8422. Preparedness on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business with data transfer speeds up to Gig E. ACS, connecting Alaska companies to each other and the rest of the world. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus, Oregon Province.
Well, it's National Preparedness Month, and there is a website where the Homeland Security Department and the private sector have set up a website that has an incredible set of resources for any household, business, interest group, and so forth to go through a checklist and see just how prepared they might be for the unexpected. And it was brought to my attention, as it comes to the attention of almost any Alaskan, that we have more than our share of emergencies in Alaska. They tend to happen several every year, as a matter of fact. We're joined by Jeremy Zydek, the State Division of Emergency Management. Jeremy, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess the big thing for your office has been dealing with the floods up there in the Yukon River.
Yeah, the Yukon and also the Kuskokwim River was affected communities along the river. They had historic flooding last winter. We had thick ice and it stayed cold for a long time, a lot of snow on top of it, and then really warm spring temperatures that brought all that water into the river, broke it up, and created some problems in those communities along the river.
Now, maybe you can give us a status right now, because the cold weather is starting to set in now. Where do things stand with, say, Eagle?
Well, in Eagle, they've reconstructed. Most of the homes have been rebuilt. They've taken the destroyed homes in the old village and relocated them to the new village. We've done that through a variety of means. The state worked with FEMA, who worked with the community. We brought in volunteer organizations like Mennonite Disaster Services, Samaritan's Purse in Eagle. And there was a lot of just volunteers from around the state that made their way to Eagle and volunteered their time. FEMA was able to provide funding to the community and the people that were affected. They were able to buy some cabin kits, which the volunteers then assembled in Eagle. So it looks like everyone that had their home destroyed will have safe and suitable housing by the time winter really sets in on the Yukon.
And we just saw the passage of the deadline, right, for individual assistance?
Well, FEMA's deadline passed a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
What happened there? The Governor Palin made a disaster declaration for a lot of different areas in the state. FEMA came in. We took them out to each and every community that had said that they were damaged. We looked at the damages there. FEMA then went back and made we made a request to FEMA for a federal declaration. They came back and gave us a federal declaration for the most severely impacted communities. The state's individual assistance programs and public assistance community programs are available to those communities that weren't as severely affected. So,
Jeremy, this is getting so confusing.
That's right. It is confusing.
What does a person do in order to find out their eligibility and so forth? That must have been a real problem. Are you the guy who has to answer the phone? Well,
there was a lot of numbers published in the communities, and what we tried to do is really get down to the community level and talk to people. Well, like for the federal program, there was FEMA members in each community working with the individuals. For our state program, we set up a 1-800 hotline number that people could call in. So there was a variety of means that we used to get that word out into the communities, what people were eligible for and which programs were available there.
Is it your experience that people are starting to like actually use the web in situations like this?
Yeah, I think that they are. Although in rural Alaska, they don't have as good internet access as we do here in the more populated areas. But certainly to get information and, you know, we use it as a tool to get information out to people so they can prepare for disasters.
Well, certainly there have been substantial changes in the way that emergencies and disasters are responded to. Some of that's money, I suppose. Some of it is changing technology. But, you know, there was a time when you would basically see uniformed personnel or fairly close to uniformed personnel, and if there was a disaster, they would just all of a sudden show up and take charge. That doesn't seem to be how it works anymore. There's this like kind of these sort of gray areas, like you say, varying jurisdictions. The state area was bigger than the federal area, and so you had all this confusion. Then you have much more volunteerism than used to be. I mean, organized volunteerism. And there's also this business, and we saw this during the fires too, that the response is sort of graded according to how bad the fire is and what the needs are. In other words, there's a lot of attention to how the resources are going to be distributed with an eye towards how scarce the resources are.
Yeah, that's true. Going back to your question about federal employees coming in and taking over uniformed people, we always want the community to take charge of the response effort and the recovery effort. It's kind of a last resort when the state will come in and try to take something over, or the federal government coming in and trying to take something over, because really these are small community problems that the community can look at and address. As the state, we can support the communities and say, what resources do you need? This is what's available to you. And then, you know, let local people handle their response and recovery.
So even though you work probably out there at the National Guard facility in Fort Rich?
That's right.
Yeah. So even though you're there with the National Guard and you're kind of under the same command, that's not your mission. In other words, it's not call out the National Guard and all these guys in uniform show up trying to fix things. You're not one of those.
Well, you know, a lot of times we work with our other state partners, the state troopers, the Department of Health, Department of Environmental Conservation, and we work with them because they already have elements in those communities, and it's easy because they've already developed relationships with the local people. And then we also use like charter services to get people in and out of villages. A lot of times during a disaster, the normal economic balance is upset. And if we bring in a bunch of military resources to support all of these missions that we have, we're really taking the economic base of the area, especially in a small community, and just kind of taking all that money out, which can be a hardship to those business owners later on down the road. So we do like to try to use local people to accomplish those local missions.
Well, my sense is that I wanted to get an update on preparedness, and I'm certainly getting one. There's an awful lot to learn. Our guest is Jeremy Zydek, a spokesperson for the State Division of Emergency Management. Do I have that right?
State of Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
See, I knew you were going to make it more confusing. Sitting across from me also is Don Hartman, a petroleum geologist and a survivor of the 1964 earthquake. Don, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You were obviously a geologist back in 1964. Where were you?
Well, I was living out in West Turnigan, just right close to the big slide. And I was working downtown, of course, in our office.
And so what was your first thought when it hit and it went on and on, from what I understand, went on for an awfully long time?
Well, I grew up in Southern California, and I went through a lot of earthquakes. And I always rather enjoyed them. They were exciting.
See, you're such a geologist.
But this particular day, I was out on Northern Lights about 50 yards from my house, pushing my neighbor's car to try and get it started. And it started shaking, and I figured, well, hey, this is a nice earthquake. And then it kept going, and then it got big. You know, a 15 to 20 second earthquake is a really gets your attention. Well, this went on for 20 seconds, and then another 20 seconds, and then it just kept it getting stronger all the time. And it ended up about 3.5 to 4 minutes. And that was just huge. I didn't know what was happening, really.
Did you think about your home? And
oh yeah, I could see my house. It looked like a boat on the water. It was just rocking in the waves, and no way I could get to it. I could just barely stand up.
Wow.
So I just had to wait for everything to quiet down before I could run over to the house.
You still could, though. It wasn't in the area that liquefied.
No, the slide, the main slide, was just 300 yards away. And, of course, the slide kept going for 10 to 15 minutes after the earthquake stopped.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, it took a long time. I walked over to my house, and I got my family, you know, kind of situated. And we looked over at our neighbor's garage, and it slowly disappeared. It just sunk out of sight. What is this? It was just awesome.
Wow.
And where there used to be a forest, there was clear sky. It was gone. The slide had just taken everything out.
I really appreciate you reliving that for us. It's really, I can see it all as you describe it after all these years.
Yeah. I was glad to be there, but I don't ever want to be there again.
Well, you know, we're here to talk about preparedness. And I guess what was remarkable in the town of Anchorage was the lack of casualties. And that was not the case elsewhere, where the tsunami was, you know, really deadly, like Kodiak, for instance. But you know, when you look back on that, what did that tell you about preparedness? What you decided from then on you were definitely going to have in your house or whatever?
Well, at the time, you figure you're really going to be prepared for the next one. But then over the years, you figure, well, you know, that was bad, but it won't happen again. I don't think anyone's ever prepared for a major earthquake or a major flood or a tornado or a hurricane. It's just human nature. If we were prepared for everything, we'd live in a little fortress with a huge stock of food downstairs and lock our doors. But
every once in a while, this stuff will come in handy, though.
Well, it would. But we know there will be more earthquakes, and there'll be more big ones. So we're just, we kind of figure we know what we'll do, but we're not expecting it every day.
Well, that's why I think events like this Preparedness Month are a good exercise, because they at least focus the attention back on and people think about what their options might be, like, for instance, water, Jeremy.
Yeah, you know, we recommend that people have 1 gallon of water per individual in their home for each day, and have at least a 3-day supply.
Now, so this could be as simple as just bottled water.
Some bottled water, and also identifying other water sources in your home. There's your water tank in your home, your hot water heater, and you can pull, like mine's a 35 gallon. So I have 35 gallons of water at any time that I can pull out of there. And then if there is a disaster or something that's approaching, you can take pots and pans and fill those up with water, have a little bit extra reserves. Just taking some steps, kind of identifying when there may be a disaster. We can't always predict them, but planning a little bit ahead. In your kit, you should have water, as we've talked about, food, a first aid kit, a flashlight, medication that you may need, some dust masks. You know, a lot of these things are things that we already have in our home. And if you put them all together in a kit,
just to try and dig them out of the garage would take you several days.
Right, right. And you might not have access to your garage. It may be flooded or it may have collapsed or something. But if you put all of those items in one kit and have them ready to go, you'll be much better off. So really, there are what we recommend is people get a kit, make a plan, and be informed. So with that kit, you're going to want to talk to your family members about where they need to go during the disaster, that you have a point of contact, someone that lives outside the area that everyone can call or email to check in and say, hey, I'm okay, I'm still at work, the phone lines are down or the email's down, but if you can get out on cell phone, there's always some way to get a message out. Also having important documents like the proof of ownership documents, birth certificates, having copies of those with someone. And that can even be a photograph of those documents that you send to a trusted family member that lives outside the disaster area. Those things are hard to replace. If you lost all of those items, it would be hard to replace in a normal circumstance.
Yeah, I bet you people in the villages that were hit by the flooding, in fact, there may be some listening to us, probably are right now, that might want to call 1-800-478-8255 and talk about the top 10 things that you wish you had had when the water started rising. You know, some of the stories are just pretty amazing because nobody, you know, it's not unusual for there to be some flooding, but this just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and people thought they were prepared, and then, whoops, the four-wheeler's on high ground, but I can't get to it now, on and on. There are things, I'm sure, some lessons learned, and it'd be great to hear from people who actually have that up-close experience. What we've learned from Don Hartman is that it doesn't take very long to forget your good intentions for preparedness. And that's the subject today on Talk of Alaska, Vulnerability and Preparedness. The local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. You can weigh in by email at talk@aprn.org. Well, let's go to the phones here, and Tom joins the program from Anchorage. Tom, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm getting by. What we're continually faced with in a lot of these emergency response situations are response to affected people who built their residences in known hazard zones, natural hazard zones, and or facilities that were improperly sited, you know, in the way of natural hazard. And obviously the best example of that is the Drift River Oil Terminal, you know, sited in the floodplain of a active volcano. They actually built it during an eruption. And so I was hoping that I could get a better insight on how the responders interact with the regulators to prevent stuff like, you know, building in Bootlegger's Cove or on the edge of the fault zone or site, you know, tank farms being sited in the floodplains of, you know, rivers where ice or volcanic activity could affect them, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of feedback mechanism happens between the responders and the regulators, and how can we improve that to prevent having to scramble to situations that we could have avoided in the first place?
Tom, that's a great question, and it's probably more something to think about than anything anybody can address, because you can't, the people whose job it is to respond are more than happy to respond, more than happy to make reports, but they can't make anybody listen to them, Jeremy, right?
Yeah, and, you know, with a facility like the Drift River facility, I think that there's certainly been a lot of improvements made on where they place facilities like that. A lot more studies, environmental impact statements, and those types of things are done nowadays than they have been in the past. One of the problems that we continuously face with individual homes is that there's not a lot of code enforcement out in the rural areas. You kind of build where you want and build whatever you want. So it's hard to go out there and regulate individuals in all of these small communities.
It's a non-conforming housing is the rule in Alaska.
Right. It's kind of what materials you have and what you can put together there.
Right. And also just the political process over years. I mean, I watched the Turnagain building closer and closer to the bluff in the Turnagain area. And, essentially... If there's economic interests that have a relentless pressure campaign, sooner or later the policy sector is going to cave in. It's as simple as that. And the best you can do is get people to realize that they're accepting the risk. And I think, Don, I don't even think that works. Because they can say, I accepted the risk, but, it's got to be in their deed.
Sure. Well, all along the Turnagain Bluff now, there are great big homes, and they're still being built. And I think it's just a little bit foolhardy, but it's wonderful view property, and people own that property, and they say, by golly, I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
The Captain Cook Hotel was built right on one edge of the L Street Slide, and it was an act of defiance.
When you said, by golly, I'm going to do it, it was almost like you were quoting Governor Hickel.
that whole street is high-rises now. And L and K are all, right on the edge of the zone.
We got one of them that's actually kind of sloping its way on down the slope. It was built that way.
Yeah, and somehow I would think that the responders have to stand up and scream bloody murder and tell them that you're placing an unreasonable burden upon their departments to respond to disasters that are inevitable when you do that kind of development.
Well, Jeremy can do some of that, but the fact of the matter is that it's his boss and his boss's boss. And where's it going to be? In a cabinet meeting or whatnot? And it's going to be in the proportion of things, and it takes like a lawmaker or somebody who's actually involved in the making of policy in order to really get anything to move.
And, I'm not an engineer, but I would hope that a businessman, when they do create and construct a large business like that or a large building, that they would take mitigation measures and make sure that the building could withstand whatever the environment might throw at it. So,
and there is a lot of that now.
Right.
There is a code with regards to earthquake vulnerability.
Certainly for large buildings, there's been tremendous improvements made on making them resilient to earthquakes and all natural disasters. Homes require shear walls built into them so they don't collapse during the disaster as well.
Yeah. So there has been some. Tom, I want to thank you for your call. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Don Hartman, as a geologist who was here during the quake, who actually lived right by the Turnagain zone and watched the woods disappear into Cook Inlet, what was your, as the time went on after the quake, how did Alaska and the country respond?
Well, there was a huge response. Of course, everyone who had relatives in the South 48 were convinced that Anchorage was destroyed, either on fire or underwater. And this went on for days and days and days. But finally, the word did get out. And as for emergency response, well, we had power within 24 hours. And we had an emergency water system in about 2 weeks. They laid pipes up and down the streets, and you could connect hoses to them and get water.
And what would people do? I mean, until the hype, basically, they would have to go to the water. That's how it worked, yes?
Yeah, well, at first, the National Guard had water trucks going up and down, handing out water. Mm-hmm. And then they laid these temporary pipes along the streets. And we could get water from that.
Mm.
And until they finally got the water mains repaired and back in shape.
So where were the squeezes in supplies? Was there a food problem?
Well, there was initially, but the markets were all very generous. They opened up and they didn't charge exorbitant prices, and everybody got enough food that they really needed.
And how big were the bases at that point? I guess it was just one base, right?
Well, no, there was Elmendorf and there was Fort Richardson, mm-hmm. both. And they were about half the population, just like they were for a long time.
So how did their infrastructure survive fairly well in the...
I believe so, yes.
Mm. Yeah, that was probably pretty handy.
They kept operating.
Yeah.
It's not quite like a flood. You know, an earthquake happens all at once, and then you get to work. But a flood, you can see it coming for days and days, and then it lasts for days and days, and then the aftermath, it goes on for months.
I didn't even think of that. Good point.
Yeah, earthquake is traumatic, but it's pretty brief.
In a way, ashfall, which I think is a prime danger to communities. I mean, in Homer got pretty substantial ashfall this year, and it can linger more than, say, an earthquake, really, in some ways, because all that dust just doesn't just go away. It's in the air.
It takes years for it to go away.
Yeah.
It's just everywhere.
So how prepared do you think we are for a big dust fall in, let's say, Anchorage, Jeremy?
Well, I think that we're pretty well prepared, and one reason is we've gone through dust falls in the past. So what we saw this last readout eruption was that people took the measures that they needed to take. They went out and got dust masks. They knew what to do. One nice thing about Alaskans is that we're not easily rattled. You know, we'll say, okay, we have this volcano here. What do we need to do to get through it? If we have cold weather, we're used to enduring some environmental hardships. So we're pretty resilient. I think that we're well prepared for an ash fall. There's things people can do. Again, having those respirator masks in your emergency supply kit, you can use those for volcanic eruptions. If there was some type of terrorist event where they release something into the atmosphere, certainly those masks aren't going to completely protect you, but it can filter out some items. We have H1N1 outbreak right now. Those masks are a good idea to have those around for that disease. So getting that emergency supply kit can really serve a lot of different purposes. We can't just prepare for one type of disaster. We got to look at our environment and say, well, here in Alaska, we have floods, fires, H1N1, volcanoes, earthquakes.
Smoke. Sometimes we got smoke.
There's a lot of different hazards that we face, and being prepared for all of them starts with getting that emergency supply kit.
All right, Jeremy Zydek, State Division of Emergency Management. It's preparedness we're talking about today as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Pace Correspondence School offers the education you desire for your child. They have state allotment for students not currently enrolled in a public school, K-12 curriculum, and supportive certified teachers. Pace now offers services for dyslexia, including assessment and tutoring through the STRIVE program. Enrollment information available at 866-864-5491 and paceschool.net. This message sponsored by the Craig City School District.
It's Talk of Alaska. It is Preparedness Month, and that's what we're talking about today. We have Don Hartman, a survivor of the 1964 earthquake, on Talk of Alaska, and Jeremy Zydek, the State Division of Emergency Management. And a blistering email from Tom, who says, during a fast-moving forest fire near a residential neighborhood outside North Pole this summer, the only source of timely information was the comments section of the Fairbanks Daily Newsminer. Their reporter was calling in information that a staffer would post and neighbors were posting. Afterwards, I asked the borough if they'd used their reverse 911 system, and they said no, they didn't want to overuse it, even though it can target just the homes in the affected neighborhood. Plus, they said it costs money for every call made, but that wasn't the reason they didn't use it. They also haven't implemented the features that allow people to register other phone numbers, cell, and work for their address or email text notices. As the broadcast EAS system has shown, unless the public is used to a system being used, it tends to be ineffective. Jeremy, I imagine you're pretty familiar with all that.
Well, our division handles natural disasters. The Division of Forestry and BLM have the primary responsibility for wildfires. So I'm not exactly sure why they didn't use the reverse 911 system.
No, of course not. But the broader question of when the system is put to use, it doesn't always do what you thought it would do.
That's right.
I've seen the EAS be activated for a tsunami that didn't come anywhere near happening, for instance, telling people on their own radios to go to high ground right now.
Well, you know, with natural disasters, we're not really sure what they're going to do. If there is a earthquake that's over a 0.5 in magnitude and it may trigger a tsunami, then we ask people, you know, get to higher ground. It's hard to tell sometimes if that tsunami is going to be rolling.
Yeah. I understand all that. But the fact of the matter is that this was just not well thought out, because it's the nature of a tsunami that it takes a while to move, and that it's depending on where it's located, the center is you're going to know when the wave hits shore. You start knowing just what you're dealing with there.
Well,
it's focused and all that.
There is that type of tsunami, but yeah. Really the deadlier tsunamis are local tsunamis. So an example is Resurrection Bay, where there's a subsurface or above surface landslide, and the earthquake causes a large chunk of land to break off and move into the water, which displaces water, and that kind of sloshes around in that bay like a kid in a bathtub.
Oh, yeah.
And that can roll up. And those types of tsunamis, you don't get a lot of warning on.
No.
We always recommend that if people feel violent shaking for 15 or more seconds and they live in a coastal community or they're next to the coast, that they head for a higher ground, because you just don't know. Our emergency alert system, we do use that, test it quite often, and it's a good system.
Oh, yeah, I think it's getting used more, but, I think the point still remains that if you don't use these things, nobody knows what they are when they happen. You know, you can get those horns, the tsunami horns they have in Hawaii, you know, people don't know what they are.
We actually have 5 communities that are tsunami ready, and what that means is that they have the horns, They have a plan for their community, what they're going to do. So they have all their evacuation centers and so forth set up, evacuation routes, but also that they have a community education program, because without the people knowing what those sirens mean and knowing where those evacuation routes are and when to act, it's not as effective as just having one of those elements. So they have to have them all working in concert.
Don Hartman, you said growing up in California, you used to really enjoy earthquakes. Do you, after 64, do you still enjoy the ride?
If they're small, I don't mind them at all.
Really?
Yeah. But I find myself just hesitating. Is this going to get stronger? What am I going to do if it really gets big?
I'll
bet.
But
as long as it's small, why, they're not bad.
Yeah. Well, you're sitting here and kind of listening to Jeremy talk about the different types of tsunamis that you can have. Is there anything you want to add to that?
Well, he's exactly right in what he was saying. The waves that devastated Seward and Valdez were satious.
Yeah.
They're actually satious, where the waterfront just simply dropped away. It was just a buildup of mud and silt, and it just dropped out into the bay and created this huge wave that just sloshed back and forth. But then Seward, of course, was hit by the real tsunami in addition to that. And so, of course, it was Kodiak.
So are they the tsunami-ready communities?
Seward, Homer, Sitka, Valdez, and Kodiak are tsunami-ready. And then we have...
Very good. You've done your homework.
We have quite a few others that are working to become tsunami-ready and are in some phases of that. They have to have a sufficient number of sirens, and we work with with NOAA to certify those communities as tsunami-ready.
Let's go to Heidelberg, and Sean joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Sean. Whoops. I think we lost Sean. Let's try Gregory then from Dillingham. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Gregory.
Hello, hello, gentlemen. Good topic. I'm kind of a realistic. I look at my assets and my debits and for the future. So when I see so many people here in Dillingham looking at foreclosures for not paying city taxes and having their electricity cut off for not non-payment and their phones cut off, I kind of live in a world of a backup for a backup. And what I'm trying to say is the permanent fund is due at the end of the month.
I think we all kind of are thinking about that, yes.
Hey, free money, yabba-dabba-doo. Let's go to the mall. Let's go out to eat. I don't think so. I think we should fill up our oil tanks for our heat, pay our electric bills. I mean, put money for the future months ahead. Pay all your taxes. You know, a third, a third, a third. If you got any extra, well, then go for the food. But I've already got them bases covered. Like I said, I'm realistic, self-employed. I buy new supplies. I pay off my employees. I get advertisement for new projects of the future, for future jobs. Buy new tools, equipment, all kinds of things like that, so that I can survive through the winter time. And I like to play as much as you guys do, but I can't play unless the job is done. I can't sleep at night. I get these, my conscious talks to me in my sleep where I got to do this, I got to do that, but I don't want to. I want to go play. No, you can't go play. You got to go to work and make more money.
Gregory, I want to thank you so much. You said it all. Thank you. Jeremy Zydek, this business about throwing some money into your kit, that's not such a bad idea. It wouldn't have to cost the whole dividend, though, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's small kits that you can build, a three-day kit. You probably have all that stuff in your home. We have a larger, expanded seven-day kit, and what we've done is breaking it out over 24 weeks. So each week you collect a few items, then after 24 weeks you should have a 7-day supply for your entire family.
Where does a person find out about this?
You can go to www.ready.alaska.gov. That's our website. And click on the 7-day survival kit calendar.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the 2009 Fall Sea Storm Guide and a lot of other great information on our website there that you can look through, and it'll help prepare you for a lot of different threats that we face here in Alaska.
Okay, it's National Preparedness Month, and our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage, 550-8422. You might bear email in mind. It's talk@APRN.org. And Dave joins the program from Cordova. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dave.
All right. Good morning, Steve and the other gentlemen. Thank you so much for addressing this. It's something we tend to sleep through. It's not really sexy. But,
the point that Don was making was, and he went through the 64 earthquake, and I said, well, did that make you more prepared? And he said, well, for a while.
Yeah. Well, that familiarity breeds contempt, yeah. Et cetera, et cetera. On topic, mentioning Resurrection Bay, I lived in Seward for a number of years and I ended up running an oyster farm down there in El Dorado Narrows for quite a while, and got to see a lot of rockfall that was, what was just from weathering, and some pretty scary stuff on occasion. But there's a geologic feature down there on the, just below the spit, there's a rock wall. It's on about a 30-degree incline, and it's probably near a quarter mile long and several hundred feet high and goes up the hill. I can't tell quite how far, but it looks pretty loose. It's a massive, massive chunk of rock. It's the whole side of the mountain, basically. And it looks like it's been getting weathered and water's been running underneath it. And it'd be kind of interesting to have somebody check that out. It would definitely wipe out Seward. It would plug up El Dorado Narrows. I intended to get a picture of it for the U.S. Coast and Geodetic Survey crew I was working with on a research charter, but I never got around to it, and now I'm living in Cordova. But if ever anybody connected with this wants to go down and have a look at that, I would hardly recommend it. If it cut loose, it'd just be, oh boy, don't even want to imagine.
Well, thank you, Dave. That's really interesting. We already had that Anton Anderson episode, where the Portage Tunnel.
That was a doozy. I could see that from the jet flying from Cordova to Anchorage this spring. It looked pretty impressive from up in the air, too.
Yeah. I would suspect that there's a bunch of other ones. I mean, you brought this one to our attention. Not that we can do anything about it. Here we are. We're just radio. But still, it's I'd really appreciate it. It's interesting to think about this. And there would seem to be a concern. You're not talking about the Lowell Point, the road out to Lowell Point, because that's what seems a little sketchy on the way out there even.
Oh, yeah. It's constantly getting closed in the winter, whether by avalanche or rockfall. It's you're taking your life in your hands half the time when you're going out there. So yeah, we've got plenty of in fact, I noticed a good one on the Seward Highway when taking the train down to Whittier here about a week and a half ago. There's one you can't see from the road that's up there. They had to shoot one out of there a number of years ago, but this one's even bigger up there, and I'm going, it's it's constantly constantly moving on us, I think. So it's great that you're bringing this to everybody's attention. I do appreciate the program.
All right, Dave from Cordova, thank you very much. Jeremy, anything you want to jump in on this with?
I think the caller brings up a great point that, it takes people that live in these communities to identify these risks. There's local emergency planning committees that they can join. There's other things like they can volunteer with the Red Cross, get involved with their schools, their churches. There's different recovery organizations that they can get involved with and really kind of identify what their community faces. work with the state, work with other agencies to see if they can mitigate those risks.
Well, Don Hartman, as a geologist, do you kind of echo what our last caller said, that there may be a lot of places where there's a slide vulnerability and people, you know, only those in the know would see it?
Oh, there are many, many of them, yeah. weather and gravity brings mountains right down. It always happens.
Yeah, well, were you surprised when that Anton Anderson collapse happened and they said, oh, it's more than just a backhoe for this one?
No, I wasn't surprised at all. This is when roads and railroads are cut into mountainsides, things are going to fall.
Wow.
There's just no doubt about it.
So I guess what Jeremy is saying is probably a very good point, that it's really up to the locals.
Excellent, yeah.
Yeah, to whatever, form a committee, organize around it, or at least so that people are aware of whatever that hazard or vulnerability is. And that's especially the case in Alaska. Because we got more disasters than anybody.
We've got a wide range of hazards and threats. One nice thing, though, is here in Alaska, we have really individuals. A lot of individuals come together and make communities. And we're kind of used to doing things for ourselves. And we live in small enough communities that one person really can go and make a change. So I urge people to really get involved with their communities, look at the risks that they face, and just some small things that they can do with their friends and neighbors can make a big difference during a disaster.
National Preparedness Month is the subject on Talk of Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
We're with Jeremy Zydek, spokesperson for the State Division of Emergency Management. Jeremy, we heard that there has been some upgrading of emergency communication. Maybe you could give us an update on all that.
Yeah, there was the Public Interoperable Communications Grant that here in the state provided one-time funds to a lot of different jurisdictions, a lot of different boroughs, emergency managers, for them to upgrade their communication equipment and make sure that different agencies could talk across lines during a disaster. The state is about to receive this week our Mobile Unified Command Center, which is a communications vehicle where we can have satellite uplink to phone and internet, and that's going to be able to really, along the road system, provide a mobile command center that will really help us out during disasters.
You know, years ago, one of our sponsors for our Iditarod coverage was Iridium, and they gave us Iridium phones, and we found that because the horizon has risen up around you, like in some places, it didn't work real well. We were very aggravated with it. Then Iridium Company went out of business, and the government took them over and said, we can't afford to lose this. And it turns out now that the Iditarod has been experimenting with the Iridium system, and whatever the improvements have been made, it's just working so much better now that you really have effective satellite telephone service.
Yeah, and certainly satellite telephones are a really great tool during disasters. We'll have satellite phones that we can send out to communities that have lost communication and kind of establish a communication link with the outside world. Going back to the spotty coverage, we found that it has improved in the last few years, and it continues to get better.
Yeah, apparently they've found ways of engineering redundancy. I mean, the system, I guess, was very redundant anyway, but they found ways of getting more redundancy, so even the little bits of data that they can combine the different pieces of data, I guess. Computers are wonderful things.
Yeah, as it gets better, it will make communication with those rural communities even easier. Even cell phone coverage is really expanding to places like Bethel. GCI now services Bethel, and that makes things a lot easier, that people can call out and call for help when they need it, identify what they need, and then get that message out.
Genevieve from the municipality of Anchorage puts in this quick note by email. Anchorage's threat of tsunami is extremely low, according to the Tsunami Warning Center. According to studies by NOAA, the USGS, natural geographic boundaries of Cook Inlet protect Anchorage from a major tsunami. Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's right. We're safe from tsunamis, but there's a lot of other disasters that we face here. And
boy, you got that right. And Don Hartman here sat through one, or stood through one, was trying to get a car to move as the 1964 earthquake happened. Don, if something like that happened now, I'm thinking we wouldn't get out of it so easily.
No, the population is about three times what it was in 1964. And there would be a commensurate amount of damage, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I would think, like, just the supply line problems, even though we have better technology, we no doubt have better geotechnic engineering. Mm-hmm. We got codes in our buildings and so forth. You know, I don't think that would protect us all that much from those giant high shelves in the box stores. They'd probably all come down. You know, I can't imagine that they wouldn't. You know, I'm thinking that probably maybe socially too, you know, do you think people would pull together the way they did then?
I think they probably would. It's been my experience that whenever something really, really dreadful happens, why people almost always pull together. They don't run around different directions screaming. And on a future earthquake, one thing that would be vastly better than it was in 64 would be communications. We were practically cut off from the outside world in 64, and that certainly wouldn't happen now.
Yeah, you know, we saw in Katrina, some systems totally broke down, and I think this is really the pattern, and maybe even the lesson of the show today. Things are not necessarily going to work as expected. You need some redundancy, and you need individual. There's no substitute for individuals taking individual responsibility. There's no substitute for us. So we saw, for instance, in New Orleans, that what really worked was talk radio. And because all the transmitters were down in New Orleans itself, it was like Shreveport, the Shreveport radio station, taking phone calls from whoever could call them by cell phone or by whatever means that was getting out the best emergency information. After a while, the public officials were using it, and you know, that was just the best way. And similarly, Tom was telling us it was like the newspaper and the website that was getting the best information out. That's not an easy thing. Not an easy thing.
Yeah, it's not. And, you know, we make an emergency kit, we have a plan, we're informed about the threats, but a lot of those things can change. However, if you do have a plan and some of those elements work, those are things that you have planned for, and it makes making those other decisions a lot easier. If you can't get water, if you have that supply of water, that's something that can help ride you through those days. If you can get water, well, then your water was redundant, but you never know. You never know what you're going to need in those disaster circumstances. So
I think it's a real good one that you brought up was the medication issue.
Right.
Because there's so many people that with chronic ailments, that say diabetes, you know, that, you know, really need to have that medication. And, you know, how many of us could say we've got our supply laid up right now and current?
Yeah, having some extra medication is a big deal. Also, you know, people don't think about their pets when they're making their supply kits. And a lot of times people are very attached to their animals. They want to take them with them. But, you know, shelters, emergency responders, their priority is people first. Even if you feel like your dog Daisy
is... You mean if I have to take shelter in the school, I can't bring my cats?
You may be able to bring your cats. There are shelters that do take animals, and they're set up for that. But certainly having enough supplies for your animals.
Very good point. And it's one thing that brought up in the national website, www.emergencyinfoonline.org, is this idea of if you are disabled, there are certain things you really need to think about. It's just really, I mean, I call that thinking it through. I appreciate that type of thoroughness. And that's probably what it takes. You know, it's like the family actually saying, okay, now if he had to fire drill, this is how it would work.
Yeah, this is where we're going to meet.
This is the window you would and so forth. Yeah, very good point. We're talking about preparedness, and maybe Jeremy Zydek, you could at this point tell us the website that the state has for Ready.
Yeah, the state's website where you can get a lot of great preparedness information is www.ready.alaska.gov, or you can go to the federal site, which is just www.ready.gov.
I was hoping that we could get into some of the security matters, the airport security, the passports, and so forth, but it's just there is not enough time in a one-hour radio show. We'll probably come back to it, but we're basically at wrap-up time now. Don, I thought maybe you'd like to have the last word here.
Well, I mentioned that the Anchorage area is three times what it was in 64. I think it's nearer to five or six. Mm-hmm. And we're sort of waiting for the next earthquake, but not with bated breath. I was glad to go through that one in 64, but I don't want to do it again. And I think we are much better prepared now than we were then.
Yeah. Jeremy, what is the status as far as people wanting to contact you? Are you the point person? When they call those 800 numbers, who do they get?
Well, for our disaster assistance, we have call takers that have been trained to take the individual assistance applications. To contact me, you can call 428-7077. That's 907-428-7077.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Talk of Alaska. Also, thanks to Pat Yak for working the phones, BD Trantina, Gooseberry Peter at the controls. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender, ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Tel Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tel Alaska, on the web at telalaska.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.